Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Joel Brinkley, a professor of journalism at Stanford, syndicated columnist, and former New York Times correspondent. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker this evening, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, Washington Post senior correspondent and associated editor and author of the new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. I've known Rajiv for a long time, since we both covered the federal antitrust trial against the Microsoft Corporation in Washington for our respective papers 12 years ago. Our careers have followed somewhat similar paths. We both worked in Iraq, and Rajiv wrote a great book about Baghdad, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, and I can tell you that I can verify almost everything in that book because I experienced the same things. We also both worked in Afghanistan, the subject of his new book and tonight's talk. Rajiv has served as the Post's national editor, Washington Post's national editor, and an assistant managing editor in 2003 and 4. He was the Post's bureau chief in Baghdad, where he was responsible for covering the reconstruction of Iraq, supervising a team of Post correspondents. Before the Iraq War, he was the Post bureau chief in Cairo, covering much of the Middle East. Prior to that assignment, he was Southeast Asia correspondent based in Jakarta for the Post, and in the months following September 11, 2001, he was part of a team of Post reporters who covered the start of the war in Afghanistan and events in Pakistan, some of the most interesting, difficult countries in the world. His Iraq book won the Overseas Press Club Award, the Ron Ridenhour Prize, and Britain's Samuel Johnson Prize. The New York Times named it one of the 10 best books of 2007. It was also a finalist for the National Book Award and the New York Public Library's Helen Bernstein Award for Excellence in Journalism. Rajiv joined the Post in 1994 as a reporter on the Metropolitan staff. He subsequently served as the paper's Washington-based national technology correspondent. That's where he and I met. He's a Bay Area native and holds a political science degree from Stanford University, where he was editor-in-chief of the Stanford Daily. He lives in Washington, D.C. Please welcome Rajiv Chandrasekaran.
Thank you, Joel, for that kind introduction. What he didn't tell you was he had the good sense to, after spending time in Iraq and Afghanistan, to make his way to Stanford. I somehow foolishly still seem to be living on the East Coast. Anyway, it's great to be here and in the presence of so many old friends. Having grown up in the Bay Area, it's nice to see some familiar faces here, so thank you. And thanks to the Commonwealth Club, one of America's great institutions of public affairs, for having me here this evening and for its impeccable timing in bringing me out here. Yesterday was my father's 70th birthday, and so I got a chance to celebrate here with him in person. It was just lovely. I'd like to start out by saying that I really didn't want to write this book. When I set out for my first trip to Afghanistan in early 2009, I assumed that if there was a book to be written, it would be about how President Obama and his team managed to reverse years of strategic drift and neglect and turn around a failing war, how they managed to snatch victory from the proverbial jaws of defeat. And after spending 2 years in Iraq, watching President Bush's merry band of neoconservative political appointees, many of them inexperienced 20-somethings chosen more for political fidelity than nation-building expertise, I expected Team Obama to show us what can happen when the pros are put in charge. I wasn't thinking we'd get peace a la Germany and Japan after World War II, or the Jeffersonian democracy that the neocons so foolishly thought they could birth in Iraq. But I was hopeful that the United States and its NATO allies could return Afghanistan to where it was in late 2001 and early 2002, when the Taliban were on the run and a brighter future seemed a certainty. While I was on that trip in early 2009, President Obama decided to send 17,000 additional troops to the war front. For Obama, Afghanistan had been the good war, the war that began with two fallen towers, not the war that stemmed from faulty intelligence and exaggerated claims of weapons of mass destruction. In August 2007, then-Senator Obama had declared Afghanistan the war that has to be won. He pledged to deploy more forces, and he vowed not to repeat the mistake of the past when we turned our back on Afghanistan. As a senator, Obama had thought that fixing the Afghan war would be relatively straightforward. The effort simply needed more resources. When he began campaigning for the presidency, he pledged to add about 10,000 troops and increase non-military aid by $1 billion. The 10,000 figure was what the top U.S. military commander in Afghanistan had been seeking, but the Bush White House at the time had refused to act on it, in part because the Pentagon brass said that every available unit that wasn't resting, training, or otherwise committed was in Iraq. By the fall of 2008, right after he had won the election, the new commander in Kabul, General David McKiernan, upped the number, saying he needed 30,000 troops in Afghanistan. But once again, President Bush punted. Obama and his advisors assumed that the 17,000 that he approved, plus 4,000 additional soldiers he authorized for training the Afghan army, would satisfy the Pentagon. The commander in Kabul said he didn't need the rest of those forces until the end of 2009. And soon after approving the new troops, the president signed off on a new strategy document that was supposed to guide the Pentagon and the State Department in the use of those troops and resources. Obama made clear that his aims in Afghanistan and Pakistan would be clear and focused. They were to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan. But the plan to achieve that goal was going to be expensive and expansive. Instead of focusing in on killing and capturing al-Qaeda leaders, the new White House plan envisaged building an Afghan state that would be strong and stable enough to keep al-Qaeda leaders from returning to the country from its sanctuaries in Pakistan. That involved doing what the Americans should have done back in 2001, building an Afghan government, training a new Afghan army, and providing essential services to the Afghan people. But with the Taliban in control of large swaths of the country, pulling all that off in 2009 was not going to be nearly as easy as it could have been 8 years earlier. To do so, the military would have to implement a counterinsurgency strategy. COIN, as the military calls it, concentrates not on hunting down the bad guys, but protecting the good people, the civilian population, from the insurgents. The idea is to separate the good from the bad, focus on the good, depriving the insurgency of the popular support it needs to sustain itself. COIN theory draws on what worked and what didn't in efforts to suppress guerrilla movements in places as diverse as Malaya and Algeria. But it requires resources and time. Protecting civilians means ensuring law and order, providing basic services such as education and health care, setting up government operations, mentoring local security forces, and rebuilding infrastructure. It sounded ambitious, and it was. But Afghanistan was the good war, and the price tag didn't seem all that high. Obama thought he had already paid for most of it, with the 17,000 troops and 4,000 trainers. Of course, as you all know, that wasn't enough for the military. When it became clear that Obama was ready to sign on the dotted line of a COIN strategy, Defense Secretary Bob Gates and Joint Chiefs Chairman Mike Mullen sacked General McKiernan, the commander in Kabul, who thought 30,000 was enough. The man they selected to replace him, General Stan McChrystal, came back to the president with a new price tag, 40,000 troops on top of the 17,000 and 4,000 trainers. In an assessment he sent to the president shortly after taking command, McChrystal warned that if NATO forces failed to reverse Taliban momentum within 12 months, defeating the insurgency might no longer be possible. More troops alone, he stated, will not win this war, but under-resourcing it could lose it. The status quo, he said, will lead to failure. McChrystal's request led to sticker shock in the White House. All of a sudden, the COIN strategy that the president had so quickly approved a few months earlier had a new price tag, more than 100,000 total troops on the ground. The president convened a series of lengthy discussions with his war cabinet in the White House Situation Room to discuss McChrystal's request. Those in uniform, Admiral Mullen and General David Petraeus, then chief of the U.S. Central Command, strongly supported McChrystal's request. They believed COIN had turned Iraq around, despite strong evidence that many of the most important factors in improving security had been in play there before the surge troops arrived in Baghdad. In Afghanistan, COIN didn't involve separating warring parties in a civil war, but something far, far more challenging, trying to convince the majority ethnic Pashtun population to cast their lot with President Hamid Karzai's government. But the problem was that Karzai's administration was often more rapacious and corrupt than the Taliban. How could COIN work when the locals were turning to the insurgents to protect them from their supposed protectors? COIN also required patience. It can take years before a besieged population feels safe enough to demonstrate allegiance to their nation. But the commanders downplayed those risks and costs. After the Baghdad surge, America's military leaders embraced COIN with the fervor of the converted. It became their defining ideology, just as free market economics and Jeffersonian democracy were to the neoconservatives who had led the United States into Baghdad. The civilians in the war cabinet were not sold on the McChrystal plan. Vice President Biden, Rahm Emanuel, and David Axelrod were among the most skeptical. The vice president doubted Karzai and the Pakistani government would be truly supportive of a more expansive COIN campaign. Instead, Biden argued, the military should focus more of its existing resources in the country on pursuing Taliban leaders and any al-Qaeda operatives that dared to sneak back into Afghanistan from their sanctuaries in Pakistan. In private conversations with the president, Axelrod and Emanuel questioned the cost in dollars, American lives, and support among Obama's base of Democratic Party voters of sending tens of thousands more troops to spend several years on foreign soil. CIA Director Leon Panetta regarded al-Qaeda, not the Taliban, as the real threat, and he knew from intelligence reports just how venal and predatory Karzai's government really was. Even the American ambassador in Kabul, Carl Eikenberry, opposed a troop increase. He sent a cable to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton outlining his objections. He wrote, "I'm concerned that we underestimate the risks of this expansion of our mission. Sending additional forces," he argued, "will delay the day when Afghans will take over and make it difficult, if not impossible, to bring our people home on a reasonable timetable." He then went on to list six reasons why a surge wouldn't succeed. The first one bears repeating. President Karzai, Eikenberry wrote, is not an adequate strategic partner. The proposed counterinsurgency strategy assumes an Afghan political leadership that is both able to take responsibility and to exert sovereignty in the furtherance of our goal, a secure, peaceful, minimally self-sufficient Afghanistan hardened against transnational terrorist groups. Yet Karzai continues to shun responsibility for any sovereign burden, whether defense, governance, or development. Eikenberry's cable delighted Joe Biden. In the sit-room discussions, Biden emerged as the most vocal skeptic of COIN. Unmoved by the claims of McChrystal, Petraeus, and Mullen, he kept questioning the rationale for additional forces. How do we know COIN's strategy works in Afghanistan? Why don't we first try to develop a proof of concept, he argued. There wasn't a secret good cop, bad cop relationship with Obama and Biden. The vice president had long been dubious about sending more forces to Afghanistan, and Obama simply let him articulate his assertions and his questions. In my reporting for this book, I obtained a memo that Biden sent directly to Obama, spelling out his concerns about the military's principal justification for more troops. The memo, which has not been revealed before, is something I just want to read to you very briefly. Biden wrote to Obama, "I do not see how anyone who took part in our discussions could emerge without profound questions about the viability of counterinsurgency. Our military will do its part. They will clear anything we ask them to clear. They will hold anything we ask them to hold. But no one can tell you with conviction when, and even if, we can produce the flip sides of COIN that are required to build and transfer responsibility to the Afghans. An effective and sustainable civilian surge, a credible partner in Kabul, basic governance and services, and competent Afghan security forces. We simply can't control these variables, yet they're essential to the success of COIN. Biden didn't want to cut and run. He was willing to send about 20,000 additional troops, so long as they were focused on training the Afghan army and conducting missions to kill or capture Taliban leaders. His proposal was dismissed as unworkable by Mullen, Petraeus, and McChrystal, all of whom who argued without clear evidence that it would be impossible to conduct successful counterterrorism operations without a COIN mission to gather intelligence. In the end, as we know, Obama sided with his commanders. He decided to give them almost all of what they wanted, 30,000 more troops. The surge did come with conditions. The most significant requirement was that U.S. forces start coming home in July 2011. He took the deadline from the military's own documents, stating that American troops could clear areas of insurgents and then transfer responsibility to Afghans in 18 to 24 months, setting a date Obama believed would force the Afghans to work faster in building their government and security forces, and it would ensure that the Pentagon would give him the in-and-out surge he wanted, not a slow series of rolling deployments followed by even slower reductions. A month later, in January 2010, I was preparing to accompany the first wave of surge troops as they assaulted a Taliban stronghold in southern Afghanistan called Marja. It was a nasty place. Hundreds of insurgents had holed up there. They had set up bomb-making factories. Many of the farms in the area grew opium-producing poppies, the sales of which helped to fund the insurgency. As I looked at Google Earth images of Marja, I noticed something fascinating. North-south irrigation canals, as razor-sharp as the avenues of Manhattan. In a land of mud-brick homes and farm plots that were clearly demarcated without the aid of surveyors, these canals struck me as odd. Someone else had to have built them. But who? It wasn't hard to find the answer. It was in the Library of Congress, the National Archives, and in the files at the U.S. Agency for International Development. And it was on the Internet, a story suffused with relevant lessons for our latest attempt at nation-building. But few in Washington had bothered to read about it or connect the dots. It's a story that begins quite remarkably with the Holocaust. As the Nazis forced Jewish fur traders to shut their businesses in Central Europe, many of those able to flee moved to New York. And once in America, they had to find new sources for pelts. They soon turned to Afghanistan, whose hills abounded with the Persian fat-tailed sheep. The soft, curly black fleece of their newborn lambs could be turned into lustrous coats and hats. In the late 30s and early 40s, Afghanistan exported between 1 and 2 million of these pelts a year to the United States. Because of currency exchange controls that functioned as a tax, the sale of each pelt put a few more dollars in the Afghan king's treasury. At the end of World War II, as Europe began digging out of its rubble, Afghanistan was sitting on a comparative windfall. It had $100 million in gold and foreign exchange reserves in its treasury. And the 32-year-old king in Kabul, Mohammad Zahir Shah, decided to use his fur profits to vault his primitive landlocked nation into the modern era. He had been impressed with what the United States did in the Tennessee Valley during the Great Depression, and he had visions of doing something similar in his country. He wanted to harness the raging waters of the majestic Hindu Kush and transform a valley along the Helmand River into a fertile oasis, a breadbasket with modern farms that would ease the pain of frequent food shortages and put the country on the path to agricultural self-sufficiency. In 1946, the royal government hired the San Francisco-based firm Morrison Knudsen that had built the Hoover Dam and the Bay Bridge for some of the king's most influential ministers and advisors who had been sent at great expense to study in the United States. The project was about more than just creating new farms. They wanted to bring to Afghanistan the America that had dazzled them in their school days. New villages would be built with modern schools and health clinics. Nomads would be resettled. Families from different tribes would live next to one another rather than in separate villages. Girls would be educated, and women would cast off the head-to-toe burqa. Eye-for-an-eye Islamic justice would be replaced with written laws and august courts. Professional government men from Kabul would supplant the gray-bearded elders who wielded power in the provinces. It was to be a grand social engineering experiment, and the English-speaking, suit-wearing Afghans who had the king's ear saw in the Morrison Knudsen engineers from San Francisco the ideal partners for the transformation of their nation. For Morrison Knudsen, the project began in the spirit of America's great post-war ambition. In a 1949 company newsletter, MK boasted, "In a country where nails practically were unknown because houses are built of mud, where wheels had not been seen until recent years because camel trains moved through the country, a forward-looking government has sought American engineering and construction know-how to bring it irrigation, hydroelectric power, and modern roads." But the slush agrarian vision soon ran aground. A Morrison Knudsen study found that the soil in the new farmland was very shallow, and below it lay an almost impermeable layer of subsoil. Think of the Helmand Valley like a giant planter box without drainage holes. When irrigated by the Afghans, who tended to flood their lands, water pooled on the surface, and when it evaporated, it left salts in the soil that stunted anything that was cultivated. The royal government began to develop reservations about this project. Morrison Knudsen's answer was to expand. Company executives advocated an ambitious program that included constructing a dam and a reservoir and even more canals. Before beginning the work, the company planned to conduct some soil and drainage studies of the entire valley, a standard prerequisite for projects like this, to avoid ending up with more waterlogged tracks. But when the Afghan government dismissed the need for such work, the company didn't object. They all believed the venture was too big to fail. To save money, the Afghans had planned to do some of the work themselves, including digging drainage ditches to keep water from pooling on the farms. But the Americans had hired all the competent Afghan engineers to work for the contracting firm, so the Afghan government couldn't meet its share of the construction obligations, and as a result, the drainage canals that were supposed to be built never got built. Many settlers wound up living in tents, building their own mud-walled homes, and watching their fields turn into marshes. At the same time, something else unique was built there. The American engineers, who had been sleeping in camps, wanted a comfortable place to live. So they constructed for themselves a new town along the Helmand River. It, too, was going to be part of this grand social engineering experiment. Once the Afghans saw how the Americans lived, the Americans assumed the Afghans would aspire to build similar communities for themselves. The town they built was about 8 square blocks. It had almost identical white stucco houses and very lush front lawns. Neighbors could wave at each other because there were none of those ubiquitous compound walls that surround every other house in Afghanistan. The country's first and only co-ed pool was in the town, as was a co-ed high school. They had a town store that sold cans of Coke and packaged food that had been shipped in from the United States. There was a clubhouse that featured nightly card games and a Filipina barkeeper who'd mix you a potent gin and tonic. Weekly square dances and regular dinner parties where everyone got tipsy. On weekends, adults lounged on front porches or under the gazebo at the pool. The Americans called the town by its official name, Lashkar Gah, but the Afghans in the area soon came up with their own term for the town, Little America. As the first signs of trouble with the irrigation project appeared in the early 50s, the Afghan government began complaining to U.S. diplomats in Kabul. As dissatisfaction increased, the U.S. Embassy over there urged the State Department to commission an independent study of Morrison Knudsen's work. So the U.S. government hired an outfit called the Tudor Engineering Company, also based here in San Francisco. And in 1956, it issued a lengthy report exonerating Morrison Knudsen and accusing the Afghans of harboring unrealistic expectations for the development of their country. What the Afghans didn't know at the time was that the Tudor Company was just part of Morrison Knudsen. Its office address was the same as that of MK's Afghanistan division, 74 New Montgomery Street, right here in San Francisco. The Tudor report failed to appease the Afghans. In 1959, the King's government terminated its contracts with the company, and soon thereafter, the newly created U.S. Agency for International Development took charge of the project at U.S. taxpayer expense. Salvaging the project quickly became one of USAID's top priorities. American specialists discovered a fatal flaw in the design of the canal. It had been built too low. Had it been built higher, water would have flowed down the fields. So the American engineers came up with a solution. They would move the Afghans off the land, bulldoze the land, and then allow everybody back. But the farmers feared they'd receive less land or their plots would be taken from them. So when the American bulldozers came in, the Afghans met them with rifles. The Americans were forced to back away. By the time the early 70s rolled around, U.S. funding ran out. Aid thought that spending more money was just going to be a fool's errand. And in July 1974, the project ended. Then a few months later, Henry Kissinger, then Secretary of State, showed up in Kabul. And the Afghan Prime Minister complained to him. He said the Helmand River Project was an unfinished symphony. And Kissinger said, we'll make this right. This time, however, a tiny part of the U.S. bureaucracy showed up there called the U.S. Soil Conservation Service. And they came up with a plan to simply have the Afghans dig drainage ditches by hand. Maddeningly simple. And it worked. And within a few years, farm yields increased by 75%. The Americans thought they'd finally found the solution that had bedeviled them for years. But a year later, there's a communist coup in Afghanistan. And the following year, Soviet tanks rolled into the country. Washington ordered all the engineers to pack their bags. And by then, every American had left Little America. We'd finally found a viable strategy, but it was too late. Had senior officials at the White House and the Pentagon and the State Department bothered to understand this history back in 2009, it might have given them pause in advocating another grand attempt at nation building in Afghanistan. Instead, our government barreled forward with a strategy that was never going to work. In my book, I dissect the American approach to stabilizing Afghanistan on two levels. The first is strategically. That is, was the coin strategy and the surge the right decision? The second is operationally. Once the president signed off on a coin strategy and the surge, how well did the organs of our government, the Pentagon, the State Department, USAID, and even his own White House, how well did they implement that policy? Let's start with strategy. And let me state up front that I believe coin can work if the conditions are right and the cost is merited. But for coin to have prevailed in Afghanistan, several things needed to occur. The Afghan government had to be a willing partner. The Pakistani government had to crack down on sanctuaries on its soil. The U.S. government had to be willing to commit troops and money for many years. The American people had to be patient enough for security to improve gradually. And finally, the Afghan army had to be ready and willing to assume control over areas that had been cleared of insurgents by American troops. COIN failed on all those fronts, just as Joe Biden had warned. First, let's briefly talk about the Afghan government. Karzai never agreed with America's war strategy. U.S. officers and diplomats argue that tribal rivalries and an inequitable distribution of power at the local level and the government's failure to provide basic services are pushing Afghans into the arms of the Taliban. But in Karzai's eyes, the problem is the infiltration of militants from Pakistan, not the corruption and malfeasance of his government. By mucking around in the districts of Kandahar and Helmand and other places in southern and eastern Afghanistan, he simply believed that the U.S. was messing around with a self-regulating system of Pashtun governance. Karzai simply didn't believe in counterinsurgency. The Afghan people had a different reason to be skeptical of COIN. Contrary to images we see on television here, most Afghans have no great love for the Taliban. They view the Talibs as religious zealots, but they have no great love for their government either. So when American troops told the Afghans that their mission was not just to improve security, but to bring the government to remote villages and valleys, many residents recoiled. Whoa, they said, we may not like the Taliban. We don't like our government either. And that was a key point that Washington failed to grasp until too late. And the Pakistani government? Well, after the Taliban leadership relocated to Pakistan in late 2001, they were provided safe harbor by Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI. Talibs were allowed to meet and reorganize and even reestablish networks inside Afghanistan. But the Pakistani spies refrained from giving them overt assistance. But in mid-2009, as American surge forces began flooding into southern Afghanistan, the ISI adopted a far more hands-on strategy. They were concerned that U.S. gains on the battlefield could hobble the insurgency, so the ISI spy masters began interacting more with Taliban commanders, now providing them arms and intelligence, and according to some reports, providing them with new forms of explosives that were seven times more powerful than the ammonium nitrate fertilizer they used to make their homemade bombs. Was the price tag worth it? You know, it costs $1 million to keep one service member in Afghanistan for a single year. That meant the annual bill for the war last year was about $100 billion. Is achieving a marginally less bad outcome in Afghanistan worth the expense? With other pressing security challenges, Iran, North Korea, democratic transformations in the Middle East, or not? Is it prudent to be tying up so many forces and dispersing so many precious dollars in Afghan villages? The surge has also exhausted American patience. The war was in its eighth year when Obama decided to surge. Even though many Americans shared the president's view that Afghanistan was the good war, only a slim majority of Americans supported the decision to search. Although commanders-in-chief shouldn't use polls to guide their strategic decisions, public support is essential for any drawn-out campaign. Had all the other factors played out differently, had Karzai been a true partner, had the Pakistanis take meaningful action against the Taliban, had our nation not been in the throes of economic stagnation, then perhaps the public could have rallied around such a large war effort. But when all those indicators pointed down, public opinion soon followed. And lastly, the Afghan army. Instead of compelling Afghan soldiers into action, the surge sent the opposite message. The Afghans often decided to hang back and let the Americans do the fighting. What was supposed to be a kick in the pants, or at least a golden opportunity to work in tandem with the Americans, turned into a crutch. But lest you think I'm all about the negative, the Afghan army has emerged as a rare bright spot in this overall effort. As American troops have started to leave, the Afghans are stepping up to shoulder more of the fighting. And through it all, the Afghan army remains the country's most respected institution. If Afghanistan hangs together after our combat forces depart in 2014, it's going to be because of the Afghan army. So what should the president have done back in 2009? Well, I'm not one of those who thinks that we should have simply packed up and left. Had we done that, or even if we do that today, it likely would condemn the Afghans to the hell of a prolonged insurgency or another civil war. We still have a moral obligation to the Afghan people. When we launched the war in 2001, we made an implicit promise to the Afghans that if they stood with us against the Taliban, we'd give them a shot at a better, freer life. But that didn't require a coin strategy and a surge that tired us out. One of the main characters in my book, a State Department officer named Cale Weston, who spent 7 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, more than any other American diplomat, argued that instead of going big or going home, we should have gone long. The president needed to determine how many troops he was willing to commit to Afghanistan for 10 years or more, and then he needed to pledge that level of support to the Afghan people. That meant no surge, and it probably meant fewer troops than were deployed during the surge debate. But Cale Weston was convinced that a smaller but enduring force would be smarter on all fronts. It would appeal to the Afghans, who chafed at the presence of so many foreign soldiers on their soil. It would compel the Afghan army to more quickly assume responsibility. And it would force the Americans to focus on only the most essential missions instead of grand nation-building projects. Afghanistan, he often told me, is a marathon, not a sprint. The surge was a sprint, and we got winded too quickly. Despite all the coin assumptions that turned out to be false, our troops have made remarkable progress in the past 3 years. Parts of southern Afghanistan that were once teeming with insurgents are now largely peaceful. Schools have reopened, as have bazaars. People are living as close to a normal life as possible. But Afghanistan as a whole is still not fully secure. Eastern parts of the country are still in the grip of a Taliban faction backed by the Pakistani intelligence service. And in the south, a critical question remains. Will the Afghans, the government, the army, the police force, have the willingness and ability to take the baton from American troops as they begin coming home? Will the Afghans sustain the gains, or will the blood and treasure we have expended been for naught? Will it slip back to chaos? For all the reasons I've outlined, I believe there's ample reason to worry that much of what we've accomplished will not last. That doesn't mean the Talibs will be able to roll into Kabul with the same ease as they did in the 1990s. I don't think the Kabul government will fall as Saigon's did. The Afghan army should be able to protect major cities and other critical areas. But the insurgents almost certainly will expand control of rural areas. And they'll retain the ability to conduct frequent attacks against government and civilian targets. The foreseeable future will be messy and chaotic. But many Americans may well see it as good enough. Osama's dead. Al-Qaeda's on the ropes. The Taliban leadership has taken a beating. Could all of that have occurred without a surge? Could we have achieved a similar messy but good enough outcome without hundreds more dead Americans and thousands more gravely wounded? I believe so. Before I take your questions, I want to turn briefly to the question of how the surge was executed. I've talked about strategic disconnect. Now I want to address the operational failure. Agree or disagree, the surge was the president's strategy, and the government beneath him, the military and the civilian agencies, had an obligation to make their best efforts to implement it. But each part of our government made critical errors. The Pentagon sent too many troops to the wrong places. Instead of dispatching the majority of those 17,000 initial troops to Kandahar, this country's second largest city, the spiritual capital for the Taliban, the city which, if it had fallen to the Taliban, they would have had a springboard to take over the rest of the country, as they did back in the mid-1990s. Instead, we sent the bulk of the new first wave of additional forces to neighboring Helmand province, where we were doing all that engineering work. But we sent them to a part of Helmand that was home to fewer than 1% of the people. Why, you might ask? Tribal rivalries. Not in Afghanistan, but in the Pentagon. The U.S. Marine Corps, which comprised that force, didn't want to work side by side with the U.S. and Canadian armies. They needed their own patch of the sandbox, so to speak, where they could bring in their own helicopters and their own logistics convoys. And so we gave them a part of the desert where comparatively few people live. The civilian surge, which was supposed to occur in tandem with the militaries to get diplomats and reconstruction workers out to Afghanistan, unfolded very slowly. Most of the diplomats that showed up in that first wave wound up being stationed at the vast embassy compound in Kabul, not getting out into the field where the soldiers needed their assistance. Although there were lots of Afghans in Kabul even to collaborate with, most of those staffers were required to stay on the well-fortified embassy compound. From the outset, the surge was bedeviled by a lack of initiative and creativity back in Washington. Instead of scouring our country for top talent to fill these essential jobs, the State Department simply turned to retirees. We sent a 79-year-old man to the reconstruction team office in Kandahar, and then they simply waited for resumes to come in over the transom. Most were from contractors who had worked in Iraq, often on wasteful projects that had accomplished little. The result was almost as embarrassing as the first year of the Iraq occupation, when the Coalition Provisional Authority had given a 24-year-old who had never worked in finance the job of reopening Baghdad's stock exchange. One USAID field officer sent to Helmand was reassigned after she got into a fight with Marines because they wouldn't give her an air-conditioned trailer. In one of the other safe districts of Helmand province, Nawa, it simply couldn't hold down a State Department rep. The first left and never returned. The second did the same, but not before admitting to his colleagues he didn't know what the term ANSF was, a very commonly used acronym for Afghan National Security Forces. The third guy finally did stay because he'd been fired from his previous job as a town manager in Virginia. USAID poured too much money into the country. Afghanistan had been starved of reconstruction assistance during the Bush administration, but Obama's response was to flood the country with dollars, far more than Afghanistan could reasonably absorb. In 2010, we tried to spend $4 billion on development projects in Afghanistan. In one district of Helmand, that equated to more per person than the annual per capita income. All that said, this still comes back to grand strategy. Had Obama gone long instead of going big, it would have forced the Afghans to do more for themselves, and it would have led the Americans to pursue more modest and sustainable initiatives. Fewer troops also would have meant fewer bureaucratic obstacles and turf battles. Less could have been more. But taking that path would have required a first-term Democratic president with no military expertise who had promised during his campaign to fix Afghanistan to stand up to his troop-hungry generals. Surging was the easy thing to do, Cale Weston said. It's much harder to say no. Although far more Americans perished on the beaches of Normandy and in the jungles of Vietnam, Afghanistan stands alone in the annals of American warfare. It's the country's longest war, longer even than the Revolutionary War. It's a forgotten war. With no draft, the fighting has been left to a small cadre of professional officers and volunteer grunts. And it is by far the most complicated war our nation has prosecuted. Troops have been told to befriend villagers and bombard insurgents with the same fervor, often in the same day. Commanders have been ordered to fight with fewer forces and in less time than they wanted. Diplomats and development experts have been required to work in environments that were more dangerous than they had signed up for. All told, I spent 3 years observing Americans' attempt to defeat the insurgency in Afghanistan. For a long time, I believed that we could pull it off, if only we had enough people, money, and patience. But the real challenge wasn't headcounts, budgets, or public opinion. For all the grand pronouncements about waging a new kind of war, our nation was unable to adapt. Too few generals recognized that surging forces could be counterproductive, that the presence of more foreign troops in the Pashtun heartland would be a potent recruiting tool for the Taliban. Too few soldiers were ordered to leave their air-conditioned bases, with the siren call of Baskin-Robbins ice cream in the chow halls and big-screen televisions in the rec rooms, and live among the people in fly-infested villages. Too few diplomats invested the effort to understand the languages and cultures of the places in which they were stationed. Too few development experts were interested in anything other than making a buck. Too few officials in Washington were willing to assume the risks necessary to forge a lasting peace. And nobody, it seemed, wanted to work together. The good war had turned bad. For years, we dwelled on the limitations of the Afghans. I believe we should have focused on ours. Thank you.
Our thanks to Rajiv Chandrasekaran for a wonderful speech, Washington Post senior correspondent and associate editor and author of a book on this very subject, just out, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Now we're going to open the floor to questions, but if I may, I'm going to ask a couple of questions first. What role do you think it plays, Rajiv, the fact that Afghanistan is arguably the most primitive nation on Earth? It has the world's highest infant mortality rate, 150 of every 1,000 children die before age 1, 26% die before age 5, has the highest stunting rate in the world, 60% of children grow up stunted for lack of nutrition during the early years, meaning they won't be very tall or very smart. It has the highest illiteracy rate in the world. 70% of people are illiterate. On average, Afghan consume 3 watts of electric power a year. 3 watts. Now you think about how many watts a 60-watt bulb consumes in a minute and average that out. And pedophilia has been common for centuries and is just as prolific and as accepted today as it was before we got there. How does all of this, this primitive nation, how does that affect what the United States and NATO have been trying to do there, in your view?
Joel, that's a great question, and it speaks to sort of both arguments here, if you will. On one hand, it speaks to just how difficult and seemingly impossible a nation-building effort there is. And this idea that you can sort of start to create local governments from scratch when you don't have people who can read and write. I mean, the Afghan security forces, I was out there just a couple months ago, and we were at a base, and General John Allen, the top U.S. commander there, was asking the Afghan army how many working Humvees they had, and they only had 12 out of the 36 working. What was the problem? Well, they hadn't requisitioned spare parts. Why? Because nobody in the unit could write a requisition order. You know, the Afghan policemen can't fill out arrest forms. I first learned that having a pen in the pocket of your shalwar kameez in Helmand province is a sign of social status because it means you can write. So we were trying to do a lot of stuff in a country where you just didn't have this basic human capacity to do it. That said, it also speaks, I believe, to a moral obligation that we have to continue to assist the Afghan people. And that doesn't necessarily mean through large troop deployments, but it does mean in an ongoing way helping them address some of the most pressing and most basic needs, basic nutrition, basic maternal assistance, basic education, basic health care. Afghanistan is incredibly deserving of this assistance. They have been plagued, unfortunately, by some terrible leaders who've squandered money and assistance, and Western contractors haven't helped this by the way they've carried out their activities. But the Afghan people still need help. It was reassuring to hear that the international community pledged $16 billion at the conference in Tokyo over the weekend. There are some new conditions that require the Karzai government to fight corruption. Question is, you know, will they, and will this money be effectively spent or not? But there's no doubt that there are real serious needs in Afghanistan.
One more short question, then I'll turn to yours. When Obama took office and the generals came in and briefed him, which you chronicle in your book, Don't you think Obama must have known that it is impossible for any general to say, sir, in my theater, I think we can't win? If I have, that's impossible. That's not what they're always trained to be optimistic. They always have to predict that they can win. And I kind of felt that Obama was being kind of naive by just accepting that.
Not only do generals often, or, you know, as you know, right, general's not going to say we're not going to win this, or it's a rare general that says that. They also always want more forces. You never meet a general who doesn't believe he couldn't do things with more resources. So, you know, that is not surprising. You know, what was particularly unique, and I think should be of some concern when we look at the broader issue of civilian-military relations, is that this was a debate that really broke down between civil and military lines. The initial advocates were the uniformed military. The initial skeptics were the civilians in the president's war cabinet. The military should not be in the position of advocating for policy outcomes. The military is the institution that carries out the policies that are set by the civilian leadership of the country. And in this case, what you had was essentially, I don't want to call it a politicizing of the military's role, but they played a far more outsized role in this debate than perhaps our founding fathers may have intended in terms of the role between the army and our civilian leadership. Yes, eventually, Defense Secretary Gates and Secretary of State Clinton did come on the side of wanting more troops, and I do think that decision then, you know, put the president in a more difficult position in terms of being able to say, you know what, I'm not going to give you everything that you want. But you know, look, I wish I could peer inside his head and see what was really going on there, and was, you know, did he really harbor those grave doubts, but did this because he felt that there was no other way out, that this was the more politically expedient thing, or did he really believe that they could turn this around with those additional troops and believe the claims of his generals?
I agree with you, and I'll go to the questions, but I'll make one comment. No president can take office and then immediately lose a war.
That's right.
So
not
you
one,
have to
and,
do
not
something.
One that you've campaigned on being right. The good war and the one you're going to win, right? And I think that this also reflected, just very briefly, a lack of proper full thinking about Afghanistan during the 08 campaign. It was all about Iraq. Iraq's the bad war. We're gonna end that war. And you couldn't be, as a Democratic candidate, against both wars. So you had to pick one. So Afghanistan became your good war. And so that created a degree of sort of baggage for you when you got into the White House that he had to then deal with, and he couldn't be seen as flip-flopping right away on that.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of San California radio program. Our guest is Washington Post correspondent Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who is discussing the internal workings of the Obama administration, particularly as related to U.S. policy in Afghanistan. Now some questions from our audience. The progress in Afghanistan seems stalled. American money seems like bribery in Karzai payola. What would be the consequences to the U.S. to just leave?
Well, if we were to leave en masse tomorrow, and not just leave in terms of troops, but in terms of financial support as well, the Karzai government would probably crumble, and the Taliban would be able to then roll into many more parts of the country. We essentially pay for the Afghan army. The paycheck or the bill for the next several years is going to be about $4 billion a year, but somewhere between 2 and 3 coming from our taxpayer dollars. It may seem like a ginormous amount of money, but compared to $100 billion to keep 100,000 troops there, it is a comparative bargain. If we were to leave, I think the whole thing would sort of pretty quickly crumble, particularly if we were to cut back on money. In fact, let me revise and amend this and say that if we were to pull out most of our troops tomorrow, I think the Afghan army would still be able to do a pretty good job of holding on. Right now, what they really need from us are things that the military calls enablers, medical evacuations, artillery support, close air support if they get into a really bad fight, some basic intelligence. But what they need most of all is money. It's worth noting that when the Soviets left Afghanistan in 1989, when the last Soviet tanks left, the communist government of Najibullah did not fall right away. It didn't fall the next year. It didn't fall until 1992, after the Soviet Union had collapsed and Moscow could no longer bankroll the Kabul government. So the big question for us in terms of looking at Afghanistan's long-term sort of messy stability is going to be, what is our appetite going to be to continue to help fund the operations of the Afghan government? If any of you have seen the movie Charlie Wilson's War, the most instructive scene in that movie is the last scene, where after the Soviets are defeated, Charlie's in a meeting room on Capitol Hill fighting with a committee for $1 million for Afghan schools and can't get it.
Has there been any attempt to bypass the Karzai government by grooming other leaders at the national and provincial level, especially by redirecting aid and redevelopment funds directly to these alternate leaders?
There has been no systematic effort to do that. There's been this sort of hope on the U.S. in the U.S. government, as well as among our NATO allies, that other figures would sort of rise to the surface. But that's really hard in a place like Afghanistan, where political power is largely, you know, at the barrel of the gun, or if you sort of sit atop kind of kleptocratic networks. And so if you're not a warlord or you're not part of the Karzai mafia, it's really hard to break through. Thus far, the thinking has been, you know, if anybody sort of seems to be overtly American-backed, it's not really going to help them. It probably could hurt them. And you run the risk of further inflaming relations with Karzai. Back in 2009, during the Afghan presidential campaign, the U.S. government made it clear that it had no preferred candidate. It was an effort to try to get the opposition to band together against Karzai. The problem was you had too many opposition figures. They wound up essentially undercutting each other. And then you got to a point where you had a disputed election, a very corrupt one. You could argue that Karzai's chief opponent, Abdullah, probably may have had even more votes. But then you ran the risk of having somebody who was not 100% ethnic Pashtun potentially assuming the presidency, and what that would have then done in terms of the views of the Pashtun population from which the Taliban draws its support, what it would have done in terms of their views of the legitimacy of the Kabul government. So as yet, Afghanistan has not found its great leader. I mean, the hope back in, or the belief back in 2002 and 2003, when he showed up with his caracol hat and his cape, was that Hamid Karzai was the great savior. And we remember asking in Baghdad, you know, when these bickering Iraqis would have their own Karzai show up. You know, my, how things have changed. And, you know, if only you could get a, you know, if only Afghanistan could have, you know, a Hamid Karzai circa 2002, things might be a little better.
What has been the military's response to your book, also the State Department's? Any yet? Are they angry at you?
Look, there's a chapter in there about the antics at the embassy, and that has upset a number of folks at the State Department. But there's an interesting split, and I've heard from people on both sides of this. Those who are stationed at the embassy compound, you know, don't like the fact that I wrote about the fact that they had, you know, for instance, in 2010, such a raucous Mardi Gras party that people were urinating on the walls of the Chancery building. That said, those who are out in the field read that stuff and write me private notes saying, you know, amen, brother, thank you for telling it like it is. There's a split there between those in the headquarters and those out in the field. On the military side, the reaction's been largely positive. I've heard from a number of senior officers who believe the story is spot on, even among Marines, who I am critical of, but not critical of how they, I mean, I believe the Marines did a great job where they went. I just question whether they should have been sent somewhere else. Even the Marines have been really willing to engage in a degree of construct, you know, in with me, and willing to appreciate the constructive criticism. And I think it's a real testament to our uniformed military that they are willing to listen to points of view that run counter to some of their own pre-existing notions, and are willing to really meaningfully engage. And I found the military to be far more open-minded, in fact, and this is kind of counterintuitive, far more open-minded about contrarian views than our diplomatic corps.
I'm not surprised, to be honest. What are the general post conventional military pullout plans for Afghanistan development? Will the West still be engaged? How will the West be engaged? Will USAID be actively engaged, or will increasing NGO and other organizations still be there? Do you know what the plans are for the non-military side of this effort?
So, as I noted, $16 billion has been pledged by the allies over the next several years for Afghanistan's reconstruction and for the support of its government security forces. The question is, those are pledges. Will that actually be made good in terms of real contributions? We're in the throes of economic crisis. So are our European allies. All the countries that have essentially been bankrolling Afghanistan are suffering serious financial hardship. So there's a real open question there. The bulk of the assistance will be provided by a mixture of official government organizations, USAID, the British equivalent, DFID, and other such groups, and through NGOs, non-governmental organizations, outfits like, you know, Mercy Corps and Save the Children, many of which have been long active in Afghanistan and will continue to be active there. Obviously, the security situation poses a real big challenge here, and a big question is, as international forces draw down, as they close things like their provincial reconstruction teams, what will the security environment be for those NGOs to provide the necessary services to the Afghan people? In parts of the country, the international presence has provided a bit of a security umbrella to deliver some of these services. And in this, as we move to 2014, when the NATO combat mission ends and beyond, there's a real open question of, even if there's enough money, how will they be able to disperse it? Now, the most effective of these groups do it through Afghans. It's not a bunch of Westerners showing up trying to run clinics and build schools and such. But even those Afghans find themselves at a degree of risk in certain areas. And so security is fundamentally linked to the ability to provide this very vital assistance to the Afghan people.
Okay. Related question. You could look at Afghanistan as a model to determine the value of human rights work. For 10 years, 11 years, more NGOs per capita probably than any place have been at work there, trying to bring human rights to the people of Afghanistan. Do you see any real meaningful results?
How many of you saw that gruesome video on the web of the burqa-clad women getting gunned down by the Talibs just the other day? Horrible, horrible. So where are we in terms of human rights in Afghanistan? Look, there have been steps forward. Well, there's a Human Rights Commission. Institutions have been set up. There is an active Afghan civil society that is crusading for changes. Things are better, obviously, in urban areas than in rural areas. But this woman was murdered just an hour outside of Kabul, still in the sort of Kabul municipality. So it shows you just how far things have yet to go, or how far things haven't really improved over there. And a reminder that as international forces leave and Afghans try to step in and take responsibility, you're going to have lots of pockets of even greater lawlessness. And I'm not trying to suggest that when international troops are there, everything's hunky-dory and everybody's protected. But you may well see more gruesome incidents like this. And as the Afghans start to make a degree of local peace with Taliban factions, just because they have to do so for their own survival. This is how the conflict in places will end. The Afghans will do what they've traditionally done. They will understand the strength of their enemy, they'll understand their own strength, and they'll all sort of haggle. And they'll figure out what that accommodation is. But a principal victim, I think, will be, unfortunately, women in parts of southern and eastern Afghanistan. And this poses a real moral dilemma for the West, for whom engagement in Afghanistan, one of the real reasons to do so was to help empower the women of Afghanistan. And as we now are so tired of this war, that it's cost so much in lives and dollars, what is the real, how will the same democratic elites who are so, and even folks in the Republican Party who are so opposed to the war, how will they balance that with seeing things like this web video, which they may well see more often into the future?
American citizens seem to know little about other cultures, which seems to be more evident when a conflict generates another nation to appear in our news cycle even more often. Could widely held perceptions influence decision makers and on the ground in Afghanistan? Do we understand them well enough to help them?
No. We don't. I'd like to say that after a decade plus of this, we'd understand them better. But we're a tired, fatigued nation. And let's put aside the general public. Let's just look at official Washington. Look at things like the American Embassy. You know, 90% of the staff there turns over year to year. So, as one person I quote in the book says, you know, every summer it's like somebody presses a giant reset button on the place. So you build up expertise only to have those people go off to other assignments. Now, there are a handful of people that have made real commitments to the country, repeated tours or multi-year tours. Same on the military front, but too often even with the military, we will take a brigade from the 101st Airborne Division, send them to eastern Afghanistan, and then the next time they deploy, they are off in the south. And so, it's like saying, all right, you've had experience in Texas, so you must really know what things are like in New Hampshire. And we haven't built that sort of continuity. The other thing, though, is, you know, part of this engagement has to do with the degree to which our political leaders want to talk about this. I mean, we have 90,000 men and women in uniform in that country today. We've got thousands of civilians. When's the last time Mitt Romney spoke about Afghanistan on the stump? He's making a foreign tour and he plans to bypass Afghanistan. But lest you think I'm, you know, skewing one way or the other, when's the last time Obama, for that matter, talked about Afghanistan in a campaign event? Nobody wants to talk about it. They think it's a political loser. They think the American people hate this war. So it's the forgotten war. And is that right? Should we, you know, to me it's a great frustration. I want people to think about this. Lives are being lost. Afghan country, their future's at stake. It's directly related to our own national security. Yet the bulk of the population sort of tuned out on this. I'm sorry, I should say I commend you all for coming. Those of you who are not like family friends and just here to sort of support me, those who actually want to, you know, engage in Afghanistan, thank you. I'm appreciative.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for one last question, and it's a relatively provocative one. I'll leave for you. I was a Bush appointee as head of strategic communications for the U.S. mission to Afghanistan. It seems obvious that this crew is even more inept than those I worked with. Is that possible?
I know who asked that question, but I will maintain confidence. Look, I think it's different. I think they're different. Different forms of being, you know, I will use the questioner's word, inept, or shortcomings or deficiencies. I would have liked to have thought that, you know, when you bring in the professionals and not political appointees to this, that things would be different and better. And it turns out that development professionals, professional diplomats, make their own different sets of mistakes. And I think what it does speak to is just the limitations we have in terms of trying to rebuild other societies. We like to think that we Americans, because we come from a great democracy, can bequeath that to anybody. And I think that we often think we can do more than we really can in these places, regardless of political party. And if anything that we take from Afghanistan, I think it should be a dose of humility in all of this. The Afghan people deserve better. They deserve our assistance. But we also have limits on what we reasonably can achieve in a reasonable amount of time with a reasonable cost. Thank you.
Our thanks to Rajiv Chandrasekaran, Washington Post senior correspondent and associate editor and author of the new book, Little America, The War Within the War of Afghanistan. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind everyone that copies of Rajiv's new book are on sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to sign them if you buy them. In that room immediately following the program. I'm Joel Brinkley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club in California is adjourned.
The books will be actually signed right here, up here, so the line will form right down this aisle.
Thank you so much, and Joel.
Yeah.
Please keep
Great.
Coming back and doing this
Great.
With us.
I will be happy to.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.